忘ればや。もがうて忘ればや。So this is the correct verse. For some reason, I thought it was 25 today. It is 25 today. So what to do? Okay. I read up to 25. I didn't expect this was going to be on the board. Anyway, so maybe we'll read this verse and speak on the last one. And we can leave this one on the board for tomorrow. I don't know. Anyway, let's see what comes from reading the verse. Kalo Daivam Karma Jiva Svabhavo Kalo Daivam Karma Jiva Svabhavo Kalo Daivam Karma Jiva Svabhavo Dravyam Kshetram Prana Atma Vikara Dravyam Chitram Prana Atma Vikara Dravyam Chitram Prana Atma Vikara Kalo Daivam Karma Jiva Svabhava Dravyam Chitram Prana Atma Vikara Tat Sanghato Bija Roha Pravahas Tat Sanghato Bija Roha Pravahas Tat Sanghato Bija Roha Pravahas Tvan Mayaisha Nishedam Prapadye Tvan Mayaisha Tan Nishedam Prapadye Tvan Mayaisha Satan Nishedam Prapadye Tat Sanghato Bijaroha Pravahas Tvan mayaisha tan nishedham prapadye Destiny. Karma. The reactions of material work. Jiva. The individual living entity. Svabhava. His propensities. Essentially, svabhava means like the person's nature. There, sva means own, and bhava means nature. Dravyam, the subtle forms of matter. Interesting, because dravya can also mean the like just items or articles. Like when we're doing deity worship, there's one of the you go through all these different before you actually start the worship. You go through all these different levels of purification. And one of the items of purification is called Dravya Shuddhi, which means you purify all the items that you're going to offer to Krishna. Chetram, the body. Prana, the life air. Atma, the false ego. Interesting. Atma can be translated in quite a few different ways. Vikara, the transformations of the 11 senses. 11 senses, huh? Anyone know what they are? Yeah, the working senses, the knowledge acquiring senses, and the mind. Tat of all this, sanghata, the aggregate, as the subtle body, bija of seed, roha and sprout, pravaha, the constant flow, tvat. your
maya,
material illusory energy. Esha,
this.
Tat,
of it.
Nishedham, the negation. You. Prapadye, I am approaching for shelter. Translation. Time, fate, karma, the jiva and his propensities, the subtle material elements, the material body, the life air, false ego, the various senses, and the totality of these as reflected in the living being's subtle body. All this constitutes your material illusory energy, maya, an endless cycle like that of a seed and plant. I take shelter of you, the negation of this maya. Okay, please repeat. Time. Fate. Karma. The jiva and his propensities. The subtle material elements. The material body. The life air. False ego. The various senses. And the totality of these. As reflected in the living being's subtle body. All this constitutes your material illusory energy. Maya. An endless cycle. Like that of seed and plant. I take shelter of you. The negation of this Maya. Okay, so the previous verse was actually not spoken on this day, so I'll just read that. Jvaru vacha namami tvananta shaktim paresham sarvatmanam kevalam gyapti matram vishvot patistana sangrodha hetum yatad brahma brahma lingam prashantam. The Shiva Jvara said, I bow down to you of unlimited potencies, the Supreme Lord, the Supersoul of all beings. You possess pure and complete consciousness and are the cause of cosmic creation, maintenance and dissolution. Perfectly peaceful, you are the absolute truth to whom the Vedas indirectly refer. So here we see now that the Shiva Jvara has become very easily defeated by the weapon of Lord Krishna, the Narayana Jvara, that he's surrendering unto the Lord. And actually we see that in the previous verse, verse 24, it mentions how it says Maheshvara Samakrandam, how he was crying out in pain. He was actually calling out for Lord Shiva, please protect me. And Lord Shiva's just like standing and says, well, what can I do? This is Krishna. There's nothing he can do. There's nothing that anyone can do when it comes to resisting Krishna. What can you do? It's just like, you know, the little child, he's trying to fight with the father, but, you know, if the father says, no, I don't want it, he, what can the child do? There's nothing he can do. So it's the same here for Lord Shiva. You know, his weapon has been defeated by the supreme weapon of Lord Krishna, and there's absolutely nothing he can do about it. And it's interesting to note also that Krishna's, so Lord Shiva's weapon, what is it? But what's its nature? Heat, supreme heat. It's like so hot. And we find that sometimes it gets very, very hot, hard to deal with. And then the other weapon is Narayan Jara. What is that?
Cold.
Who likes the cold? Who can tolerate the cold? I mean, somehow or other you manage to tolerate heat. I mean, I don't mind, you know, essentially I don't mind how hot it gets. You know, but when it gets cold, I can't stand it. I've got to put on all these clothes. I wind up being like, you know, one of those Eskimo things that can't move or anything like that. You know, it's just too much. And we see that Prabhupada makes the same point in the Krishna book, that he says, doesn't matter how hot it gets, somehow or other you can tolerate it. Even you go to Vrindavan in the middle of the summer, 55 degrees, 57, 58 sometimes, 59. Somehow or other you find a way to tolerate it. I remember one year I was there in the summer and I was offering arti to Gaur Nitai, and it was in May or June, I don't remember. Anyway, the fan was on, but we had to turn the fan off when we offered the ghee lamp, because otherwise it would blow the ghee lamp out. And as soon as you turn the fan off, the sweat just starts to drip off you, just starts pouring sweat. And as soon as you turn the fan back on, it's okay. So somehow or other you tolerate. But if you're on that altar in the middle of winter, it is so cold on that altar. It's such a big, big room, you know. It's like as high as this building completely, you know. And it's very, very cold. And the same here when it's very, very cold in the winter. Very, very difficult to tolerate. You know, the skin cracks up. You know, you get blood coming out from, at least I do, I get blood coming out from the side of my fingers and things like that. Just can't tolerate it. But the heat's okay. So Prabhupada, he makes that point that it's, you know, somehow or other you manage to tolerate the heat, but the cold, very difficult. And that's why we see that the Lord's supreme weapon is ultimate cold. And what happens is when it becomes very, very cold, eventually, if it gets colder and colder and colder, everything stops. And Prabhupada also, in the Krishna book, he gives that example. He says just like when the human being, when there's approaching death, the temperature of the body rises to 107. And then death comes. And then the temperature drops. And he says the body becomes ice cold. So this is an interesting analogy. And one point I want to also point out here, it describes in verse 20, it says, just then, Banasura's mother, Kotara, desiring to save her son's life, appeared before Lord Krishna naked and with her hair undone. So, different acharyas give different presentations on these things. If you read Krishna book, Prabhupada says that actually, because Banasura is Bali's child, one of Bali's sons, Bali Maharaj, the great devotee of Krishna. And Banasura actually describes him as very respectful. He was honest. He would follow the Vedic sacrifices. So he, you know, he took some of the qualities of his father, but he was actually a devotee of Lord Shiva, with 1,000 arms, very, very powerful, but also very proud. Because often is the case when people are powerful, they become proud. Because one of the things that humbles a person is that when your intentions are defeated, when you make some endeavor to try something and you're humiliated in your endeavor and in your attempt. Yet when one is very, very powerful, they generally become proud because no one can stand in their way. And so he approached Lord Shiva, you know, because actually he had pleased Lord Shiva. He was playing, when Lord Shiva was dancing one time, he was playing with his 1,000 arms, all these instruments, and Lord Shiva was very, very happy with this. Imagine, you know, someone with 1,000 arms playing 500 madangas. It sounds pretty, you know. Just like when we sometimes have big kirtans, you know, like on Rath Yatra or in Mayapur, sometimes they have these big kirtans. You might have 10 or 15 madanga players. And it's like the whole temple room is booming every time, especially if they're playing together. It's very nice when all the madangas they play in time, they play the same beat. And, you know, when they hit the big end of the madanga, it's like the whole temple just booms. So you can imagine that Banasura, he was playing instruments for Lord Shiva. It would have been very, very pleasing. But he was saying to Lord Shiva that, well, you know, you've cursed me with these 1,000 arms. I can't find anyone to defeat. Because he's a Kshatriya. And Kshatriyas, you know, they have this chivalrous nature, and sometimes they like to fight. And so, you know, he was saying that apart from you, there's no one I can defeat. And actually, it's interesting because some of the acharyas, they interpret that actually what he was saying, the undercurrent of what he was saying there was actually, I want to have a fight with you. Just like this, is that Vrikasura who had that benediction, whoever, you know, Lord Shiva gave him this benediction, whoever's head you touch will split into 1,000 pieces. Yeah? So immediately he got this benediction, because actually why he wanted this benediction was because he was desiring Parvati. He saw Lord Shiva's wife and he thought, this would be very nice, I'd like to enjoy her. So he performed this theory so he could get this benediction so he could, you know, split Lord Shiva's head into 1,000 pieces. You know, interesting story. But the thing is, like, oftentimes people who are materialistic, when the materialistic people, they generally have an underlying motive in their endeavors. So we see here that the way he's approaching Lord Shiva, he's actually saying, I want to fight you. So by this time, probably Lord Shiva had learnt from his past previous experiences to be a bit careful here. Lord Shiva actually became angry with him and said, you know, you puffed up rascal, I curse you that you will meet defeat. You know, you'll meet a suitable foe and you will see your flag. Because on the chariot they had a flag, and when the Kshatriya was defeated, the flag would be, you know, one of the things you see, like at the Battle of Kurukshetra. Arjuna, oftentimes before he severed someone's head with his arrow, he would sever He would go through a whole, it wasn't just like, you know, he'd shoot away and, you know, he'd just kill the person. There was a whole process, you know. He'd kill the chariot driver, he'd kill the horses, he'd cut the flag from the chariot, then cut their head off. Bang, 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 like that, in quick succession. Incredible what these people would do. Just incredible. And here we see that earlier on in this chapter, that Banasura, he was fighting with Satyaki. Satyaki, very powerful, incredible personality. He's fighting with Satyaki. And then Banasura saw that there was problems in the other part of the battlefield, so he ran down there to take on Lord Krishna. So 500 bows, arrows, and he's like putting two arrows on each bow. You imagine this, he's got 500 bows, shooting a thousand arrows at a time. Just extraordinary. I mean, it's kind of, you see these movies around these days, you know, they're portraying all these different superheroes or, you know, like some, you know, like, just like modern day type of personality. They're sort of portraying themselves as being like, you know, indestructible practically. You know, the things they have happen. They jump out of cars, they jump out of planes, they do this, they do that, you know. And they just get a few cuts on their body, you know, and they just keep on going. You know, it reminds me when I was a child, I used to watch this program called Combat, and some of the older voters here probably, and the Australian voters probably remember this show with this guy, Vic Morrow. And he was just indestructible. Every show he would get shot. And he'd be back the next show like nothing happened. You know, the guy was just completely indestructible. And people in this day and age, they like to portray themselves in the movies about, you know, all these indestructible characters. Yet we see that, you know, people here are very, very fallible, very, very fallible, very, very temporary. Their bodies are so temporary. And we see, you know, the smallest thing happens. There's some small accident. You know, they might get hit by a car, just a little thing like a car, which only weighs, you know, maybe 1,000 kilograms, 1,500 kilograms, and finished. You know? Yet you see these personalities from the Vedic age, not the same as people now. Completely different. You know, like this one time, like Bhishma, he was getting shot, and the arrow went straight through his body. Like a 10-foot long arrow went straight through his body and disappeared into the earth. Shook his head and just kept going. Like nothing had happened. You know, he had arrows all over his body. He was like a pincushion, it's described. He's lying on the battlefield, you know, with these like thousands and thousands of arrows sticking, and he's still going on, maintaining his life. Could you imagine? Like you see sometimes, like these people in the movies, they get shot and they, oh, you know, they swear or something like that, like it really hurts. But they keep fighting. Now, really, could you imagine, like, someone shoots you through the leg? First thing is it'll probably break the bone. Yeah? How are you going to keep going? It's just all fictitious. It's all fictitious. These people don't have this kind of prowess. And even when you look at things like, I was listening to this lecture day before yesterday, and Prabhupada, he was talking about Arjuna. Now, when Krishna presented the Bhagavad Gita to Arjuna, how long did the conversation go for? Half an hour, 45 minutes. It's only like, you know, what is it, 680-odd verses? It doesn't take long to recite. I remember actually doing Gita Yagya with Shivaram Maharaj in London a couple of times every year for their Gita Jayanti. Maharaj, he does these yagyas. He'll go around to all the different temples in London, in England. And what they do is beforehand they get all these devotees to sponsor Gitas that get distributed by the devotees during a Christmas marathon. So he'd go around to the temples and all the people who come and who've sponsored Gitas, they get to sit in the yagya and participate in the yagya. And so he'll go through the whole Gita and, like, you know, he chant a sloka and Swaha Yidam Krishna Yidam Nama Swaha, and he does it three times through. And it's really, you know, set a cracking pace, you know, because he wants to get it done in 45 minutes. So, you know, there's no, you got to, you know, Before I did the yagya, he sat down with me and said, okay, so say how you're going. I said, Swaha Idam Krishna. No, faster. It's got to be quicker. And so finally, you know, I got it up to the right speed and the whole thing, 45 minutes, man, 700 times you've got to, well, actually 2,000 times, Swaha Idam Krishna. It's like quite a yagya. Anyway, so about 45 minutes it took. And we see that at the end of the Gita, what did Arjuna say? He said that now I have understood your instructions, I will act according to your direction. In 45 minutes, he understood. How long does Bhakti Shastri go for? Half the Bhakti Shastri is Bhagavad Gita, two modules of Bhagavad Gita. And at the end of it, Who says that I can understand Bhagavad Gita? I don't think anyone does. So we see that in half an hour, Arjuna understood completely the essence of what Krishna was saying. He says, now I understand, Karishev Vachanam Tava, and I will act according to your words. When we get to the end of the Gita, do we say that? Okay, now I've understood, I'm going to act according to your words. Not little bit changes, and we think, oh, this is good, now I can give class on Gita. But really, we haven't actually changed much. So we see different caliber of person. Even we see with Banasura, different caliber of person than what we see around, you know, in this day and age. Very, very powerful person. And we see at the end of this chapter that Krishna, to humble him, cuts off all of his arms except for two. Now just imagine someone comes and cuts your arm off. What do you think would happen? Probably faint and die of blood loss. Massive bleeding. How long would it take before all the blood comes out? Huh? How long would it take? A few minutes? Yeah? In a few minutes, because you've got big arteries in the arm. There's big arteries there. In a few minutes, all the blood would come out and you'd be dead. But we see someone like Banasura. I mean, I don't understand it. I don't understand how it works. But, you know, we accept that Bhagavatam is giving the absolute truth. And it's describing here how 998 arms got cut off. He was left with two. And yet he kept going. He went back to his town. Now, the point I was making here is Kottara desiring to save her son's life. Prabhupada in the Krishna book says that actually this is not his mother, but this is a demigoddess called Kottari. And the relationship they had was like son and mother. So you see how different acharyas, they give different understandings, different perceptions of things. And it doesn't necessarily mean that one is right and one is wrong. Because in the absolute truth, all contradictions resolve themselves within the absolute truth. So even though we see that Prabhupada explains it in one way, Jiva Goswami explains it another way, actually there was another purport here. I think here that I'm not sure, maybe it's in these purports here, how Sridhara Maharaj is pointing out how Jiva Goswami was presenting one understanding, Swami was presenting another understanding. But it doesn't mean that one's right and one's wrong. We shouldn't think like that. And also another point is like, just because we don't understand something, you know, the tendency is often that there are, like sometimes the acharyas may make controversial comments. And, you know, I'm not going to go into that because there's some comments the Prabhupada has made are very controversial and get some people very upset. And I don't pretend to understand what the acharyas are saying. I don't pretend to understand what Prabhupada means when he says certain things. You know, I accept that what he's saying is true, but I don't understand it. And this is the mood that the disciple takes. It's like, you know, what the guru is saying, yes, I accept this. You know, and Prabhupada was saying, he was giving this class I was listening to the other day, and it was a really far out class, a Vyasa Puja class that Prabhupada gave. I forgot where it was, but it was one of the, you know, just a really, really powerful class Prabhupada was giving. And he was saying that, you know, his life changed when he read the commentary of Vishnath Chakravarti Thakur, wherein he mentions that the disciples should accept the instructions of the spiritual master as the life and soul, as their life and soul. So it means like the guru gives the instruction, we accept it. This is correct. This is the absolute truth. I may not understand it. And that's just the way it is. And just like I was in this same Vyasa Puja lecture, there's a whole section there at the end where Prabhupada's talking about, you know, like you may think like, you know, he's saying how he was very happy his disciples had taken up this offering of Vyasa Puja. And he says, some people may think that I'm introducing man worship. He says, but this is not man worship. He says, Vyasa Puja is about worshipping the spiritual master who is the representative of Krishna. And he was explaining the system of parampara and how the parampara works. And it's just like, you can give an analogy, just like you give, you know, the tax man comes and you give him, you know, especially you look in the times of Lord Chaitanya, the tax man would come. I can't remember, who was that who kept the money for himself? Wasn't Ramananda Roy, was it Ramananda Roy's father? Don't think so. Anyway, one of the personalities, he was a taxman. Was it? Okay, so...
And he had to
Yeah, they're going to throw him on the chunga or something, were they? Yeah. And so one of the associates of Lord Chaitanya's father or uncle had, who was a taxation collector, and he kept the money. And he was going to be punished. They have this thing where they bury swords, put the haft or the handle of the sword into the ground. And they have 100 of them buried like that, and they put it on a platform and they just throw them onto the swords. Can you imagine a gruesome way of dying? You know? Just like all these blades just go through your body. And every part of your body, you know, face, arms, legs, everything. And so anyhow, they, you know, because this is the punishment if someone collects the taxes and they don't give the tax to the rightful owner or inheritor of the tax, then they have to suffer. So we see that the system is there with the taxation is that the tax officer collects the money, but it's not his money. He gives it to the government, or he gives it to the leader or the ruler, whatever the system is there. So the same with Guru Parampara. Parampara is like a channel that just naturally flows towards Krishna. So whatever you offer to the Parampara, we understand that that is being offered to Krishna, ultimately. Just like every day we do Guru Puja for Srila Prabhupada. So that is worship, yes, it's worship of Prabhupada as a representative of the Guru Parampara. But ultimately that worship is being offered to Krishna. Because we worship Prabhupada, what does he do? He takes the same item of worship, and what does he do with it? Yeah, exactly. Very good. He worships his guru. And then Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur will take that, and what does he do it? He will worship Gaurakishore Das Babaji. And it goes on the line to Radharani. Then Radharani gives it to Krishna. So anyway, I was listening to this explanation that Prabhupada was giving. And you know, all along I've accepted, like Prabhupada, he introduced a system, we offer Aarti to Guru. I just accept that's the way it goes. And then hearing this explanation that Prabhupada was giving Parampara, I thought, aha, this makes it very clear. Because some people say, when you offer it to Guru, then it becomes Guru Prasad. But I'm thinking, no, this would make the Guru an offender. He would be an enjoyer, because something is meant for Krishna, he's taken enjoying. So if we're thinking like this, we're thinking the Guru is an enjoyer. But this is not right. So when we offer the item to Guru, it's actually going through the Guru Parampara to Krishna. So we see that the Parampara is a very, very important aspect of the process of devotional service. And sometimes it's difficult to understand how it is that a person who has come from, you know, maybe not such an auspicious background takes up the process of devotional service and becomes a guru or a spiritual master. Yet we can understand, Prabhupada explains it, there's many nice places where he explains that. But one place where he says, because the guru is canvassing on Krishna's behalf, he's giving his life to the service of Krishna. Therefore, he becomes worshipped as a spiritual master. And there's a very nice letter where someone wrote to Prabhupada, and they were asking about this verse, Nikunja Yuno Rati Keli Siddhihai. And in this verse, they're saying, well, you know, this verse is explaining how, you know, the guru is you know, one of the associates of Krishna and the growers of Vrindavan, you know, like the Manjaris, etc., like that, and they're making all these different arrangements for Krishna's pastimes. And then Prabhupada explained in that letter, he said, but you need to understand that Srila Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur is writing about his spiritual master, who is one of the assistant gopis. And he said, whatever, he says, assistant gopi, cowherd boy, whatever, it doesn't matter. But the guru has given his life to canvas on Krishna's behalf, therefore he is worshipped. So the Guru Parampara, we cannot understand this, the concept of Parampara with the material intelligence. We have to understand this is a transcendental arrangement made by Krishna in order that our service and our worship and our affection can easily be directed towards Krishna. Because the Guru is someone who's tangible, he's there in our life. We get an opportunity to have a direct exchange with a person. You know, an example of devotional service, an embodiment, hopefully an embodiment of bhakti. Someone we can see who's practicing, tangibly practicing and giving us the example of devotional service so that we know how ultimately to surrender to Krishna. Because we see in the Shastra, there's so many examples of how to surrender to Krishna. Yet this is somewhat removed and distant from our situation. It's just like here, we'll be going through the next 10 or so verses where the Shivajwara is offering all these prayers of submission to Krishna. I mean, we can see from the verse, you know, under discussion today, actually a very, very intelligent person, a very, very philosophical person. Not just some, you know, you know, like dull-headed bully or something like that, who doesn't really know what it is. Very, very intelligent person. You've seen these verses. He's praying. It's actually quite, you know, interesting philosophy he's presenting here, where he's saying that he's comparing, you know, just like the seed and the plant. You know, the totality of material elements. It's like an endless cycle. The way this creation is coming and going, he's using this analogy of just like the seed and the plant. So there's some intelligence there. So he's using this intelligence to serve Krishna. So the point being is that we have so many examples there in Shastra, but because we're less intelligent, we need to accept this as a fact. You know, it's not like, well, okay, here I am, I'm speaking in the class, so you know, I'm talking to you. You guys are all less intelligent and I'm not, because I'm the one who's speaking. No, the fact is we're all less intelligent. Otherwise, what are we doing here? If we're so intelligent, how come we're in this world? How come we're here in Melbourne? You know, like, at least for me, I'm cold like anything, you know. And how come we've got to do so many things to maintain our existence? How come we've got to, you know... I mean, you know what it's like in this world. There's so many, you know, going to work, you know, you've got to work with all these dull-headed material fools and people who harass you and you know, make fun of you because you're a Hare Krishna, or, you know, at your school they give you, you know, a hard time because you're a Hare Krishna or whatever, you know. How come, if you're so intelligent, you've got to put up with that? No, the fact is we're less intelligent. Therefore, it's difficult for us to accept these examples in Shastra. So the spiritual master, Krishna, comes as the spiritual master. We understand this concept of guru is one. And this is not Mayavadi philosophy. The concept of guru is one, meaning that Krishna himself manifests as guru. Now, that doesn't mean the guru is Krishna. We're not Mayavadis. Understand this. This philosophy we follow is called a Chinta-Beta-Beta-Tattva. And you'll find this is manifest through all elements of devotional service. That in our philosophy, things are simultaneously one but different. We are nothing but Krishna's energy. So in one sense, we are Krishna, but we are different. Part and parcel. It means we're separate from Krishna. We're part of Krishna. We're nothing but Krishna's energy. So the guru is a manifestation of Krishna. Krishna's manifested in this form to give us this connection with him, to give us the tangible opportunity to render devotional service, to give us a tangible experience of someone who's practicing devotional service. And we find devotees are very, very inspired by the spiritual master. And you see the devotees, they perform great devotional service. They surrender more and more to the spiritual master. And this is the business of the guru, is to inspire the disciple in devotional service, to give the example, to be a guru. Is actually, I remember talking with Jayapataka Maharaj one time in Mayapur. We were on the elephant procession, and we were talking about that, how when you get a position in devotional life or in spiritual life, and you know, people are always looking to you for the example. And he said it's not very easy to live a life like that. And you see, you know, like even I've had the experience, you know, with my spiritual master, he'll write a letter and he might, you know, misspell a word or something, and the mind instantly latches on. Oh, the way he spelt this, does this mean? You know, and like you tend to like analyze all these things in very, very, you know, like very, very sort of like finite, you know, like very, very small ways, looking at every little detail. But actually it's just, you know, I didn't press the key. That's all it is, just some small thing. And we see that devotees will look at, you know, especially younger devotees will tend to look at every little thing the guru does and hang on every little word he says and, you know, and try to analyze and look for all these different meanings. But actually, the thing is we try to see the example of devotional service the spiritual master is offering and use this as our inspiration. And we see the guru is giving his life to present Krishna consciousness. This is the example we follow. Not the fact that he forgot to press a key on the keyboard when he was sending you a letter. Look at the example of devotional service. Look at the instruction. This is the essence. As Prabhupada says, there's Vani and there's Vapu. The Vapu is the form. And the tendency is for a younger devotee is like they put all the emphasis on the form of the guru and neglect the instruction. But as we become more and more developed in devotional service, we become more advanced, or we become more Krishna conscious, we see that the essence is there, is in the instruction. And Bhaktisiddhanta would say that, that the guru is present in his instruction, and the disciple who follows the instruction lives with him. So Prabhupada would often say, you know, like devotees would want to spend time with Prabhupada, and you know, always want to be serving his body and stuff like that. And he said, if you want to know me, I am in my books. So by studying Srila Prabhupada's books, we personally associate with Prabhupada. Because a lot of, you know, like Prabhupada, he put his heart and soul, I think it was into these books. I think it was in was it 1922 that Srila Prabhupada first met Srila Bhaktisiddhanta. And at that meeting, what did Bhaktisiddhanta instruct Prabhupada? He said, you look like, you know, intelligent young men. He said, you should preach this Krishna consciousness in English language. And then this Vyasa Puja lecture I was listening to the other day, Prabhupada said, he wrote a letter. Prabhupada gave the dates. You know, it was quite amazing. He had such a clear memory. He gave the dates he wrote the letter. And he gave the date he received the letter also. And he said he wrote this letter to his spiritual master, and he was saying that I'm a grihastha and I can't associate with you, I can't serve with you like your sannyasi disciples, your brahmachari disciples. But, you know, is there some instructions, is there something you want me to do? And then 2 weeks before Bhaktisiddhanta left his body, Prabhupada wrote back to him and said, yes, you know, that he wanted him to push on this Krishna consciousness in English language. He wanted him to distribute books. And so Prabhupada took this instruction very, very seriously. You know, he actually explained that it was kind of interesting, because he's saying that sometime later he had read this instruction from Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, that how the disciple must accept the instruction of the spiritual master, their life and soul. So he read this instruction and he took it seriously. And so therefore he took this instruction of Bhaktisiddhanta seriously. And it may have taken him, like this was 1936 that he got that instruction. In December of 1936, he received this letter. 2 weeks before Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur left his body, he got this instruction. And yet, we see, he was holding that instruction for years, thinking, you know, looking for the chance of when to do this. And finally, we see in 1965, he came to the West to start to preach. So it took him, quite a while, 29 years. But still, he carried this instruction in his heart. So the same way, it's like, you know, when we receive the instruction from Guru, or we see here, Prabhupada's given us so many. And ultimately, Prabhupada is our, you know, as we understand in ISKCON, is the ultimate Siksha Guru for all members of ISKCON. So these instructions are very, very clear for us in the Bhagavatam. You know, these examples of great Vaishnavas are very, very clear for us. And Prabhupada is elaborating on these instructions for our benefit. Because he's, you know, trying to explain to us, this is what I want you to become like. This is what you need to be in order to go back home to Godhead. Because this is not our place. We may be enjoying so many things in this material world and thinking it's so wonderful here in this material world. But understand, this is not our place. We don't belong here. Yeah? I mean, just look around, for goodness sakes. You know, it's such a miserable place. You know, there's like there's so many things going on, like so much suffering and accidents and fighting and wars and, you know, like I was saying, when I was in America. In America, I just don't go out after dark, especially in places like New York or Los Angeles, very dangerous places. I mean, you can go outside the temple in New York and walk down the street and someone put a gun in your face and say, give me your money. It happens all the time. You know, the temple has a policy in New York. If they have cars, they do not leave anything in the car, nothing. Not even a cigarette lighter or anything simple like that. Why? Because someone will smash the window and steal it. Guaranteed. It's such a violent place. Yet here we are trying to enjoy it. Prabhupada points out very clearly in his purport, constantly pointing out that this is not our place. Take seriously these instructions that are given in the Shastra. Take seriously. Now, Prabhupada put his life and soul into presenting the Bhagavatam. Put his life and soul into presenting the Gita. And it's very interesting. He wrote a manuscript for the Gita while he was in India. The manuscript was stolen. Who knows what happened to it? He had to completely rewrite it. Have you ever had that kind of challenge in devotional service where you put, you know, years of work into something and then gone like that? What do? Give up. Too much. This is just too much. I was just reflecting on this yesterday, because, you know, like in the service I'm doing in the ministry, like sometimes, you know, help comes, sometimes not. Sometimes, you know, people say, yeah, I'll do it. Just like with our website, you know, like for so long I've been trying to get this website. I have this grand vision of what the website should be. I've been trying for about, since about 1995 to get it happening. It's still nowhere near what I want it to be, you know. And sometimes people, they offer to come, yeah, I'll do this. And then like, you know, 6 months later you get, oh, sorry, I can't do it. There's a big long explanation why they can't do it. And so I was reflecting on this, and I think, but you know, like Prabhupada had so many obstacles in devotional service, so many personal challenges in devotional service. You read the Lilamrita, how when he was in India, and he would go out every day and he would try to distribute his books, and he would not meet with a lot of success, and he, you know, sometimes he would feel very, very discouraged, he would feel very exhausted, and then he'd come back and he would sit down and he would just think, you know, sit down, I assume he was meditating upon Krishna. Or meditating upon the day's activities, and then he would become, as described in the Lilamrita, how he'd become revitalized. So we see that Prabhupada faced many, many challenges. Arjuna faced many, many challenges. But they didn't give up. And the fact of the matter is that here we are in this material world. If you think you're not going to have many challenges, if you think you're not going to face many difficulties, you're in illusion. It's as simple as that. You're in illusion. You are going to face so many challenges. You are going to face so many difficulties. That's just part of being in the material world. Why? To help us understand very clearly that this is not our place. The material world is meant to be a place of difficulties. It's meant to be like that. It's not meant to be anything else. You know, these people who think it's a wonderful place where I can enjoy are an illusion. And at some point their illusion is shattered. We see, you know, so many big, big wealthy people. They have, you know, fabulous lifestyle. You know, they say, you know, they've got a lifestyle to die for, and people do. You know, people do die to get these lifestyles. They go out and rob banks, or go and try and shoot someone to steal their money, and what happens? They get, just like someone, you hear that story how someone broke into George Harrison's house?
Yeah.
Yeah? And what happened? His wife Olivia, it didn't kill him, but his wife Olivia took up the poker from the fire and almost beat the guy to death. Yeah, pretty ferocious. You know, pretty heroic of this lady, you know, to beat on him with a poker. But you know, this guy, he was, I don't know what his motivation was, but he was thinking, you know, he was breaking into the house trying to, you know, improve his material situation. He almost died. And that's what it's like in this material world. People take chances. Just like I saw a headline on one of the websites the other day about there's this new thing. Where people are, you know, like young men, they like to dare each other to do things. I remember that, you know, we used to, you know, I dare you to jump off the bridge, you know, into the water and stuff. We used to do that when we were kids, you know. Some of the things, when I look back, some of the things we used to do were pretty foolish. We used to go out to this waterfall. I lived up in the hinterland behind Coffs Harbour. And we used to go out to this waterfall. And there was, it was a cascading waterfall, and one of the places it sort of came down into was like a hole. And the hole was about 6 foot wide, about 3 foot wide. And it was quite deep, it was about 18 foot deep. And we used to get right up on top of the cliff and jump down into this hole, dive into the hole. And I just, you know, looking back on it, I thought, my God, I could have been killed so easily, you know. And one time I slipped as I was going off and I misjudged it. And I just went like that and I hit the rock and with my hands deliberately and just went in and I thought nothing of it. But now looking back on it, I think that's just so dangerous. And we see people are doing things like this all the time. There's this new thing they're doing, right, is they're daring each other to do things in front of trains. They'll wait till the train is just about at the crossing and they'll run across just to see if they can, you know, how fine they can cut it. Problem is, like, one day you misjudge. Squashed. There's no sort of second chances when you get run over by a train. Yeah? And material life's like that, you know. It's like we're trying to push it to the edge all the time. And one thing I've noticed recently is, you know, not noticed, it's going on, but become more aware of it recently, is as Kali Yuga progresses, the mode of passion will increase more and more and more and more. Just like we hear devotees saying, oh, I was so busy this week. I was so busy last week. I'm so busy today. That's not going to change because the mode of passion is becoming more and more prevalent. And the only thing we can do is we have to push against that passion by cultivating goodness. Goodness is essential. It's not something to be minimized. Goodness is essential. Prabhupada explains in the Gita that there's several points he makes there. He points out how the mode of goodness is the springboard to the transcendental platform. Another thing he says in the 13th chapter, he says that cleanliness is essential for making spiritual advancement. This is a feature of goodness. Without being clean, we cannot make spiritual advancement. It's essential. So you see, all these things, we have to constantly push back against the modes of material nature. If we don't push, Maya is very powerful, much more powerful than we are. It's such an easy thing for her to overcome an insignificant jiva and bewilder them into thinking that they are the body and the enjoyer. It's very easy for her. So if we don't make a serious effort, if we don't push very, very hard in order to overcome the influences of the modes of material nature, then what happens? We become overcome. We become completely covered. So much to the point is that we think that we are the body. We think that we are the controller. We think that we are the enjoyer. And every living entity in this world is subject to this. Every living entity in this world is covered by this. How many people here are convinced, 100%, that they're servants of Krishna? Huh? I don't see any hands going up. Because the fact of the matter is we're not convinced yet. Why? Because we do so many things that indicate that I'm the enjoyer. Yet we see someone like Prabhupada. His life was evidence, his whole life was evidence that he knew he was Krishna's servant. He pushed himself so hard, he had so many chronic diseases. He suffered from diabetes. Did he take insulin? No, he just kept pushing on. When he was on his deathbed, so much pain, so much difficulty. I'm always amazed when I see that video. I mean, I don't like watching the video because it kind of brings up a lot of heavy emotions for me. But when you see Prabhupada lying on the bed in Vrindavan and Jayadvaita Maharaj is holding the microphone to his lip and he's translating that I think it's the 16th chapter of the Bhagavatam, 10th canto. Where Lord... Huh? Yeah, 13th chapter of the Bhagavatam, the 10th canto, 13th chapter, where Lord Brahma, I think it's the Brahma Vimohan Lila. And it's just amazing to me that, he's in such a difficult situation. The doctors were saying he couldn't understand how much pain Prabhupada was experiencing. But because of transcendental consciousness, beyond the body, he's not thinking I'm the body. And by the process of Krishna consciousness, we can all achieve that. It's not like it's something esoteric or impossible to attain. If we apply ourselves seriously to this process, and we see, it's a gradual development, and we find that gradually we become more and more purified, gradually become more and more aware of our situation in this world, gradually become more aware that I'm not this body, gradually become more aware how Krishna is present before us in the deity. He's smiling at us, just waiting for us to come and serve him. And he's standing there very, very patiently, waiting and waiting and waiting for us to have some realization, for us to take it seriously. Yeah. The process of Krishna consciousness is a golden opportunity. The human form of life, it's a golden opportunity. Prahlad Maharaj, he makes that point in the 7th canto. Actually, it's interesting, that verse, that Kormana Achya Pragyo, you see in the start of every volume of the Bhagavatam, there's a verse. So in the start of the 7th canto, that's the verse that's there. That's like the mood of the canto, if you like. It's saying that right from the very beginning of life, from the tender age of childhood, and Prabhupada translates, from 5 years old, one should take up the practice of devotional service, giving up sense gratification. And he's saying this dulabham manusan janma, this human form of life, very, very rare. If you look at how many species of life there are in this world and how many jivas there are on this planet, you couldn't count how many jivas there are on this planet. There's so many. And here we are. We get this golden opportunity to take on the human form of life. And then people do other things besides Krishna consciousness. They're wasting the human form of life. And, if you want to waste this human form of life and use it to do activities that the animals are better at doing, fine. Take on the birth that's more suitable. If you want to eat rubbish, then you can have a pig body. If you want to have powerful sex, you can have a horse body. If you want to fly around in the sky, then have a bird body. If you want to, surf in the ocean, then have a dolphin body. You can have any body you like. It's not a problem. Krishna says in the Gita, yanti deva prahadeva pitrin yanti bhutani yanti bhuti yanti madhyajan opinam. That, you know, those who worship the demigods, they'll go and they'll live on the demigod planet. They'll become a demigod. Not a problem. You can do it. Pitrin, in this is Pitrin Yatapriti Deva. That if you want to, you know, worship the forefathers, because we see in India quite popular, they do this Shraddha ceremonies, and they do worship of the forefathers every year. And so then they get the opportunity. They can get, you know, they're missing their dearly departed relatives. I mean, it's not to say, you know, I miss my mother, I miss my father. I often have, you know, I discuss with my wife, I have fond thoughts of them and things like that. But it's not like I worship them or I want to go and live with them. No, I understand that by practicing devotional service, they will get the benefit. You know, Nrisimhadeva, he said that because Prahlad Maharaj was, like, Nrisimhadeva offered Prahlad Maharaj a benediction. He said, anything you want. He said, look, I don't care for myself. You please just you take care of my father. He says, I don't understand why you're asking. He says, 14 generations past, 14 generations future. All liberated by your devotional service because you're a pure devotee. So, devotees need to understand that, you know, just by the practice of devotional service, that our family members will get so much benefit. So rather than diverting our efforts into doing family worship or, you know, forefather worship, put that same energy into Krishna consciousness, developing Krishna consciousness, and then they'll get the benefit of that. Far much more benefit than you can get from doing Shraddha ceremonies, etc. And then so he says, Bhutani Yanti Bhuteja. And if you want to worship the ghosts and spirits, you don't see that so much here in the West, but you see it a little bit. I mean, maybe people are worshipping Elvis Presley as a ghost. Died of a drug overdose. I mean, people like that, Kurt Cobain, all these different types of heroes, you know, who died of drug overdoses generally wind up as being ghosts. And people worship them. You know, like, sometimes you go to the kids, you know, like, devoted children's or just other kids' rooms, and they have these, like, huge posters of all the pop stars up on the wall, you know. They might have their John Lennon poster or something like that, you know. And there's a form of worship's going on. And so this is Bhutani Yanti Bhuteja. You worship the ghosts and spirits, you go to the planet of the ghosts and spirits. But then he says, Yanti, what's the... In the last verse, the last line, he says, but those who worship me, they will live with me. So Krishna's making that point. He's just put all your energy, whatever time and energy you have, just put that into serving Krishna. And you'll go to him. He says, I promise you this because without fail... The quintessential instruction of the Gita Prabhupada defines it as surrender. He says, Manmanabha Madbhakto Madhyajima Muskha Mamayva Satyamte Pratijanayapayosame. Always think of me. Always. 24 hours a day. Always means, you know, that there's no time when you're not thinking of Krishna. A lot of these things, when I look up these words, I'd like to look up the dictionary definition. Prabhupada was very succinct with his use of the English language. So when you look up things like always, it means that there's no time when you're not doing it. And so always think of me, Krishna's saying, 24 hours a day, even when you're sleeping. And so it means when you're sleeping at night, you have dreams of Krishna, you dream about the deities, you dream about Prabhupada, you dream about devotees. I felt very blessed the other night. I was dreaming about worshipping shalagrams. It was really far out. I had all these shalagrams and bathing with yoga. It was nice. It was like, I haven't had a dream like that for years. And then he said, become my devotee, worship me, and offer your homage to me. So when we get to this point where we're just 24 hours a day engaged in thinking of Krishna, we're engaged in serving Krishna, we're engaged in worshipping Krishna. And he says, thus you will come to me without fail. I promise you this because you are my dear friend, my very dear friend. So through this process, you know, of serving Krishna in this way, of worshipping and thinking of Krishna, we become Krishna's friend. And Krishna becomes indebted to us. Just like we see earlier on, what's that? Na paraya aham. Krishna says to the gopis, he says, I cannot repay you. Because we see, like, this is the mood of service we're aspiring for. Not necessarily we want to become a gopi. Don't think like this. This is like, you know, we see there's certain groups in India who like to think like that. They dress up as, you see them sometimes in Vrindavan and Mayapur, really far out, you know, these men wearing saris. Yeah? And they've got a little bit of stubble on the, you know, really strange, you know. But they're called Sakhi Bekis, right? And Sakhi, they take the mood or the dress of a Sakhi. And their idea is that if I pretend, then I'll become. And so they pretend to be a Sakhi. and they dress up as a sakhi and they think they'll become a sakhi, and they you know, do all these different pastimes. You get various types of sahajas where they have this like convoluted or twisted perception of the philosophy or twisted application, and they feel by applying it in a particular way, by doing this, then I'll actually, you know, achieve this. But actually it's just a different form of sense enjoyment. They're just indulging their senses. Our process is we follow Guru Parampara. Mahajana Yenikata Asapanta. Let's describe it. Forgotten the verse. It's saying that it's not by logic, by tako pratishta shruti avabhinna naso rishi yasham matam bibinam dharmashe tatvam nihitam guhayam mahajani yenikata sapanta. Not by logic, not by studying the Vedas. Because it's saying that the Vedas, many branches in the Vedas. You know how many books there are in the Vedas? There's over 100,000 books in the Veda. Yeah? So in order to understand Krishna, you would have to, through studying the Veda, you would have to study the whole Veda. There's the Upanishads, the Aranyakas, the Brahmas, the Samhitas, so many different divisions are there. In order to understand, you know, the purpose of the Veda, you would have to understand all these things completely. You could never do it. Too many divisions. A Rishi, well, let's follow the Rishis. What's the definition of a Rishi Prabhupada gives? A Rishi is understood because he's known as a Rishi because his opinion differs from someone else. And we can see that there's so many opinions. Matam vibhinnam. Their opinions are nasho Rishi matam vibhinnam. It says matam means opinion. Vibhinnam, many branches. There's so many different branches of opinions amongst the Rishis. And you see, you go to India and you approach all these different sadhus, and they'll all give you a different idea. So how are you going to understand by that? You just become confused. Yeah? And he says, dharmasya tatva, the truth about dharma, the truth about religion. Dharmasya tatva nihita guhayam. Guha means cave. Yeah? So guhayam means secret, yeah? Like hidden. Dharmasya tatva nihitam guhayam. Mahajana yenikata sapanta. Actually, the secret of bhakti, the secret of devotional service, it's a secret, and it's hidden in the heart of the pure devotees. Mahajana. Yeah, the Mahajans is hidden in their heart. So, yenagata sapanta. We follow that path that is chalked out by the Mahajans and we'll understand the secret of devotional service. So it's a very simple process. That's why, you know, the Guru Parampara is so essential. You know, sometimes, you know, like, you hear these points 1,000 times, and one time the point just, it just hits you, and it's just like you've been hit with a truck, you know, all of a sudden you realize, oh, that's what's meant by this. Simply by applying ourselves to the process of devotional service through the Guru Parampara. No other method will work. Simply by applying ourselves to the Guru Parampara, we achieve the mercy of all the Acharyas. And ultimately we achieve the mercy of Krishna. You know, why do you want to go to Krishna directly? Why would you want to do that? You know, you'll miss out on Bhaktisiddhanta, Prabhupada, Bhaktivinoda Thakur, Jiva Goswami, Rupa Goswami, Vishnath Chakravarti Thakur, Bilva Mangal Thakur, you know, all these Prabodhananda Saraswati, all these extraordinary personalities in our Guru Parampara. Simply by going through the Guru Parampara, we access their mercy. But if we think we're going directly to Krishna, you know, one thing is like, first off, how do you know Krishna's going to accept it? If you offer something directly to Krishna, how do you know he's going to accept it? You don't. You have no idea. You just hope and pray, my dear Lord, please accept. And if, you know, maybe he will, maybe he won't, you don't know. But if you offer it to the Guru Parampara, guaranteed it'll be accepted. We follow the system. And this is why, you know, because when you, say for instance, we're doing a bhog offering, Krishna says, what's that? Patram pusham taram toyam yome bhaktya prayat. She said, if one offers me with love and devotion, a leaf, a flower, fruit, or water, I will accept. How do we know we have devotion? I mean, we do this exercise in one of the classes we do in Mayapur. I always ask, you know, who's got devotion? Surprise, surprise, no one puts up their hand. Huh? No one will say, yeah, I've got devotion. But actually, we all have. How do we understand that we have devotion? It's because we're following the process of vaidhi, sadhana, bhakti. It's a process of devotion. Because we're following the rules and regulations as given by the Acharya. As given by the spiritual master. The spiritual master is directing us. You know, when we start the worship, generally we chant this verse, Sri Guru Paramananda Premananda Palapada Brajananda Pradananda Sevayam. My dear spiritual master, who's engaged in the blissful service of Radha and Krishna, the land of Braj, Brajananda, such a blissful place. You please engage me in your service so that I can serve Krishna. You know, we're actually acting as a servant of Guru. And if we keep this mood, if we keep this mood of servant of Guru, then whatever we do will be successful. As soon as we start to think that I am the servant of Krishna, you know, that point is made in the Adi Purana, that Krishna says to Arjuna, he says, one who says he's my servant, he is not my servant. But one who says he's the servant of my servant, he is my servant. So by applying ourselves to this system that has been given by Krishna, evam parampara praptam, he's given the system. It's not some made-up system. Not some man-made system. Krishna has given the system. Therefore, it is vested with his potencies. So we apply ourselves to this system and we offer the item to our guru. And Prabhupada says in Majjhalila, for Pujaris, this is a very, very important purport. Majjhalila, chapter 24, text 334. There's a very nice statement that Prabhupada says, item 5 of the 64. He says there is an asan, a seat before the altar. This is for the spiritual master. The disciple brings everything to the spiritual master. The spiritual master offers it to Krishna. So he's explaining the simple system of the Guru Parampara. We go through the system of Guru Parampara, everything will be accepted without doubt. But if you approach Krishna yourself, maybe it will, maybe it won't. It depends on your bhakti. It depends on, you know, maybe he's not hungry. But if his beloved person is offering him something to eat or is cooking for him, if Radharani cooks for Krishna, you think he's going to say no? He'll accept because of love. So when it's offered through the Guru Parampara, it goes through the line to Krishna. And there are many, many great stalwart devotees of Krishna in that line who are very, very dear to Krishna. So by offering through this process, whatever we do, even we doing our service, you know, whether it's, you know, doing sangatan or, you know, managing a temple or cooking in the kitchen or washing the pots or going to school or whatever services we're doing it through Krishna. We offer it through our guru to Krishna and then it becomes accepted. So I just wanted to share with you some thoughts on this wonderful class I had the other day. Okay, any questions at all?
Soul is a temporal part of the here, and it is pure and eternal, which is not bewildered by Maya. So before we came here, he was a part and parcel, he's part of the Krishna as well. So as a part of the Krishna, so how he was bewildered there according by the Maya, so we have to come here.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. There's different ways you can answer this. One time Prabhupada was asked that question, he says, yes, why? Why come here? And the thing is, we're always part and parcel of Krishna. We're always Krishna's energy. Even the spiritual world are here. The situation for the jiva is we're marginal. Jivera sarupahoi krishnera nityanidas krishnera tatasta shakti beda bed prakash. That the constitutional nature of the jiva is an eternal servant of Krishna. But because we have this marginal nature, we're in between the spirit and in between, you know, Krishna's energy and the material energy, we can be influenced either way. We get covered by that. And every moment of every day, we're making that choice, how to be influenced. Will I be influenced by Krishna? Will I be influenced by Maya? Everything we're presented with, everything that happens to us, even like when the alarm clock goes off in the morning, you're presented with the same thing. Do I succumb to Krishna or do I succumb to the pillow? It's a tough choice, yeah? Especially if you had a hard day the day before. You know, so everything is that choice. And it's the same in the material world, in the spiritual world. You know, the jivas are given that choice because we have this independent nature. We have a minute independence. But the degree of our independence means, will I surrender to Krishna or will I not surrender to Krishna? That's as far as it goes. And at one point we made the choice not to surrender to Krishna. Who knows what that point was? Yeah. And we see that in the spiritual world, Krishna is the center. There is no other center. And actually, everywhere Krishna is the center, spiritual world, material world. It's just in the material world, people don't see that. In the fifth chapter of the Adi Leela, there's a very nice explanation about the position of Krishna and of all the different incarnations. And it describes ultimately how every incarnation, every manifestation of Krishna, except Krishna himself, takes the mood of a servant. Balaram's a servant. All the Vishnu avatars are servants. Radharani's a servant. Everyone except Krishna. Krishna never takes the mood of a servant. He's the supreme enjoyer. And as long as we understand that's our position, jivera surupuhoi krishnera nityadas, this is my constitutional nature, is I'm a servant of Krishna. And as long as we understand that, as long as we act in that capacity, we're situated in our rightful position, the spiritual realm. That's our rightful position. As soon as we think otherwise, as soon as we think that I'm the enjoyer, I'm the controller, why aren't they serving me? Why are they serving Krishna? Why can't I be the enjoyer? This is an improper mentality. This is an improper attitude. It's just like sometimes, I think it was about a year ago, there was some man in the temple, and he was like just, you know, behaving in a very wild manner, and the police had to come and remove the guy. You know, so he was behaving in an improper manner for the place he was. So to be in the spiritual world, or to be in the spiritual consciousness, it means we're understanding that I'm Krishna's eternal servant, and we're always acting in that way. Not that we simply give it lip service and go off and enjoy my senses. It means we always need to act in that way and think in that way. And that means we're situated. What's that? Iha yashe hare dashe kamana manasikara nikalaj vapyavasta so jivan mukta sa uchite. That one who acts to serve Krishna with his mind, body, intelligence and words is a liberated person. And even though he may be here in this material world, he's considered to be liberated. Jivan mukta sa uchite. Such a person is considered liberated. So we had a moment of independence. You know, people like to, you know, talk about being an independent individual and, you know, stand up for their rights and all this kind of stuff. And where does it get them? Material world. So, yeah, real independence means to be completely dependent upon Krishna. Because if we think we're independent, if we try to falsely have our own independent independence, we become dependent. We're forced to take shelter of Maya. But if we become dependent upon Krishna, then we become independent of all outside influences and forces of material nature. So it was our decision. Take responsibility for it. Take ownership, as they say. We're suffering here in this material world. Take ownership. You got yourself here. No one else put you here. Yeah? It was your choice. You wanted to come here. Somehow or other, for some foolish reason or other, we wanted to come here. We need to take responsibility of it. And then also take ownership of the path back to Godhead. You know, it's presented, Prabhupada's presented in such an easy, it's just like it says in the third verse of the Bhagavatam, how it's described how this mature fruit of the desire tree of Vedic knowledge, it's become semi-soft and almost solid because it's been presented by Sukadev Goswami, and it's described by some of the acharyas how, like, when the mother, she'll chew something up, you know, something hard, she'll chew it up in her mouth a little bit to make it soft, to make it more digestible, then give it to the child so the child can eat it. You see it in the West, you don't see it so much. People go, ooh, yuck, you know, people get really bothered by stuff like that. But in India, you'll see mothers doing that for the children. They'll get something hard, they'll chew it up, and they'll give it to the child so the child can digest it very easily. So the Bhagavatam has been made more presentable by Sukadeva Goswami. And also we see how Prabhupada, he's made the process of Krishna consciousness much more easy for us to understand. Like if you look, for instance, at the way his godbrothers present, or if you look at, for instance, the Brahma Samhita by Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, I mean, it's like, you know, I need to have the Brahma Samhita there next to the dictionary, because half the words he's using I've never heard of before, let alone understand what they mean. You know, so Prabhupada's presented this philosophy in such a way it's really, really easy to take it up. He's even adjusted, like you know, normally people would chant 64 rounds. I mean, I've done that half a dozen times in 25 years. You know, it's 64 rounds. It's a real endeavor. So Prabhupada made a practical adjustment, you know, because we're very, very passionate. So he's presented Krishna consciousness in such a way, very, very easy to digest and very easy to apply ourselves. But we need to do that. We need to apply ourselves.
One more question. When you said that Prahlad Maharaj was a devotee and Narasimha Dev came and he said that 14 births passed and he was 14 births passed in future. So what does it mean about the past means? He already lived that life, so how is it going to be liberated? What that mean for him? He lived for 14 past lives.
From that point onwards, they're liberated. Yes, like when Prahlad Maharaj, when he gave him that benediction, from that point onwards they're liberated. And it may not take effect immediately, just like we see with Hiranyakashipu. It's understood that in the next birth he came as either Dantavaka or Shishupala, I don't remember which one. And then and then again Jayanvijaya. So it took some Kumbhakarna Ravan also. You know, so he had to go through a few births. It wasn't instantaneous, but liberated. You know, it's like Krishna's time, our time is a little bit different. Actually, in the spiritual realm, there is no time. You know, so the liberation is there. It's just like you buy a ticket to India. Right? You go to Bhagavat Katapu, we're doing a little bit of advertising for our devotee travel agent here. You go to Bhagavat Katapu and you get a ticket to go to India. Now, it may be some time before you get there because, you know, maybe the ticket's for some time in November or something. But it's understood you're going to get there. You know, and you're almost as good as being there because you've got the ticket. So once the Lord gave that benediction, it took some time, but they were considered liberated. Because Krishna's determination never meets any, it's infallible. There's never any problem with things like that. Something else? Okay. Grantaraj Srimad Bhagavatam ki Samaveta Bhakta Brindaki Shri Shri Radha Balabaki Jai Nitai Gopremanandi.